Hey everybody, welcome to This Anthro Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Brian Collins.
Happy to be here with you today. One small celebration that we want to announce to you both is that Ryan and I are both now officially done with school, which is a crazy thing. So technically now it's Dr. Collins and Dr. Gamwell. You can still call us Ryan and Adam, of course.
Right, and we don't have to go by doctors T-A-L by any means.
Doctors T-A-L, yeah. Is doctors the plural word? I don't know. Should doctors know that? Doctors?
Shouldn't we?
We should, I suppose. Anyway, so we're happy to sort of have the sort of the yoke of dissertation writing and thesis writing off of us, and so we are excited to move into summertime. We have some awesome new content coming. We've been jamming on a number of ideas, and so one of them that we want to announce today, we've mentioned on our website, but we want to go ahead and tell it to you with the sound of our own sultry voices, is that TAL is partnering with the American Anthropological Association and the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, and we are floored and humbled that they asked us, and we're so excited to hang out and do work with them. And so what this is going to be is I'll be traveling to Washington, D.C. For 2 weeks in the end of June and the first part of July in 2018 to participate in the Center and the Folklife Festival. And this is a great festival that they do every year. And, you know, they sort of highlight different cultural groups. And this year they're highlighting Catalonia and Armenia, as well as craft fashions in Africa, and just a huge amount of 10 days of festival of different speakers and foodways and questions on cultural heritage and migration. And it's one of the things that the Smithsonian partners with the AAA with is called the On the Move program that AAA's mm-hmm. been doing. They've got this great series called 100,000 Years of Human Migration. And so it focuses again on how humans move in diaspora and migration. We've been moving forever as humans. I mean, as long as we've been Homo sapiens, right? And so the Folklife Festival and AAA have been partnering with that, so we get to hang out with them this year. So if you're in D.C. For the end of June, first part of July, hit me up, let me know, and I'll be there working with Leslie Walker, who's the AAA Education Outreach Coordinator, and Ryan will be working as kind of the oracle to the Batman, or the Birds of Prey, I suppose, in Boston. And so we will be recording a bunch of content, a bunch of interviews,
right?
And we're going to be making a really awesome special series. That we're going to kind of make some TED Radio style episodes for you that like bring into questions of migration and just a whole bunch of new people that we've never been able to have on the show otherwise. And so this is a huge opportunity for us and for our listeners. And so we're really excited about that.
Right. I mean, just the type of focus that we're going to get from this, it's going to be very broad and encompassing because the Folklife Festival has four faucets to it. Mm. There's the AAA's faucet, which is On the Move, yep. which is what Adam's going to be most deeply connected with, and with Leslie Walker as well. But you've also got to focus on Catalonia, and you've also got to focus on Armenia and on African arts as well. So we'll have a really, truly diverse cultural setting to talk about migration, not just in one direction, but on several different directions and what that means for different culture groups as well.
Yeah, so we're really excited. You know, I'll be live tweeting and taking pictures and stuff while we're there. So again, if you're there, reach out or let us know what you're interested in, and we will you know, try to put some content together for that. So we're really excited and can't wait to share that with you later this summer.
Now, for today, we were very pleased to be joined with Tricia Long, and she was a phenomenal speaker, and we know that you're going to love this episode. Mm-hmm. She had many thoughts that were initially related to business and different types of understanding of culture in a corporate sphere, but she's so engaging on a broad level and really helps anybody understand mm-hmm. the different types of language that she's going to be using because it's just about translation. So we hope that you feel inspired by this conversation. Mm-hmm. Tricia is a PhD sociologist and who's also in data science and a loving tech ethnographer.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. So she's been doing independent consulting for a long time, and so she's founded two companies, which she'll talk about in the episode, Sudden Compass and Magpie Kingdom. They each do two different things, and so we'll talk about what those are. But yeah, we came away from this episode blown away. We liked it. We loved it. Tricia is a wonderful and colorful character, and so she used different language you don't always use in the show, but it seems so right that it's going to be part of the show.
Well, we should have a language warning in front of this episode.
So listening with kids, you know, maybe.
It's very candid.
Indeed. But yeah, we found a lot of inspiration about this, and so there's so much to take away with how we can learn to communicate and understand context and work with ethnography and business and questions about data and privacy and personhood. And so we're really excited to share this with you, and so we hope you enjoy it. And so, yeah, without further ado, check out Tricia Wong. Now, how's it going? So you're traveling all the time anyway. Are you back in town now for more than 2 days, 3 days, or...?
I try to be in town now around any 40 to 50% of the time. Awesome. I really, really make an effort to be in New York City, in Brooklyn, which is very hard, but that is my goal. It's much better than field work when I was doing field work and I was gone like 95% of the time or 99% of the time, as you know, most of us are when we're deep in, deep in our work.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious to think too, like how often are you, so if you're doing 40 and 50% now is like, cause you know, cause you're doing field work from what we read, like primarily in China and Mexico, right? And and so do you split those 25 and 25%?
No, I don't get to do that much field work anymore. I am mostly on the road right now building out Southern Compass as I, you know, doing business development. But, and what that entails though, for me doing business development is doing a lot of thought leadership because I kind of backed into it where it's crazy looking at my life right now. I would say that a lot of my time is spent at least giving one or two talks a month on the road. And never did I imagine I would ever be doing this, you know, getting the privilege to speak to corporate audiences and to C-suite leaders who would listen to me. But it took me a while to even get to that point. But really, the way I got here was just that I realized that in order to do what I wanted to do, no one even understood what the problem was. Like, I'm talking about, like, yeah, we need to integrate big and thick data, and like, and all my fellow, you know, sociologists or anthropologists, anyone who comes from academia who's working inside corporations, well, not, I don't know about the anthropologists, but definitely the sociologists are like, yes, because we're all trained in quantitative and qualitative methods, so that comes very organically to us. But for the most part, a lot of social scientists working inside companies are like, yeah, and so totally cool, no arguments there. But really what I found out was that no one understood what I was talking about once you moved a layer up and any layers up. And that to me is the work of where I want to be, which is not in the middle layer, which is where most social scientists are. You're either working as a vendor and you're being hired by some manager. You know, you have some kind of vendor relationship where you like are told to do research and then you come back and you give some insights, you deliver to PowerPoint. Or you can go in-house, you know. But I was like, no, the problem is so much bigger and I need to reach C-suite level people. But in order to even reach them, they don't even know and understand the problem I'm talking about, which is that companies are over-relying on quantitative measures and it's just creating all kinds of screwed up things for people, out sort of, you know, really messed up outcomes. Are we allowed to curse on this podcast? Like, how myself can I be?
I think you should be totally yourself.
Okay, so it's creating all kinds of fucked up situations, right?
Excellent.
And I would speak like this in front of my clients or non-clients anyway, so this is just me. I have no fear of my clients seeing this.
This is perfect.
I'm very passionate about this, is that, you know, their over-reliance on quantitative numbers is what it is creating this humongous distance between people and corporations. And what I realized is like, oh my God, if I want them to understand what I'm saying, I have to actually like make a very convincing, compelling case about the problem. Mm-hmm. And so that's what forced me to start speaking publicly, because I was like, who will listen to me? Anyone who will like give me any kind of audience, like I will talk to you, whether it's closed rooms, like, you know, on stage, like I have stage fright. I hate being on stage, but you know what? I will do it. Just so I have a vision and I have a clear vision of what the problem is. And I don't know all the ways to solve it, but I do know some of the ways that I can contribute. And I wanted to do my best for that. So that's why I'm on the road so much giving talks. Because to me, part of business development, that my funnel is like a 5 to 10 year process, is that maybe my client, you know, the partners we work with, they will come back to us around 5 years or 10 years. And so, and for me, it's not just the partners coming back to us, but I give the talks as a way to change our entire industry, is that it shouldn't just benefit me. It needs to benefit all of us who are working in this space.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more on what it is that you're doing for our listeners so they can get a better feel for exactly what types of things that you're doing on the road, what your field work is, and perhaps what it means to be a tech ethnographer.
Yeah. So, you know, interestingly, I don't do field work in Mexico and China, but what I am doing is deep field work inside corporations and understanding how organizations are making decisions and how decisions actually get made and what happens when, I really believe, and I'll answer your other part of the question of what my company does, but I have a tangent to go off of, which is that I really believe that I don't think corporate anthropologists or sociologists or any of us working in this space that we truly yet understand how decisions are made and even how to make it insight actionable. It's now the buzzword. Where like before mm-hmm. it was like 5 years ago, I would speak to social scientists working in the space and be like, yeah, I just produce insights and you didn't hear the word actionable in front of it, you know? Uh-huh, like, yep. And now everyone's obsessed with being like, yeah, my insights are actionable. Like everyone says that. And I'm like, really? Do you know? First of all, I know that your insights probably aren't because I've seen your work. But second, like, what are you doing to make it actionable? Because I haven't even totally figured out. We are testing and we have ways that we are making it actionable, but we struggle at it. You know, we're not 100%. And that's partially because my team and I are still trying to really understand. We know when an insight is great, but how do we actually make it actionable? And that requires so much more of understanding how corporations work and understanding how decisions are being made and understanding the people, what motivates them who are at the top, you know, who are making these decisions. So that's just one tangent I just wanted to put out there. I kind of have a beef with like, it's just the kind of annoyance with like everyone saying they want to make insights actionable or saying they are, when really I think we have a lot more to learn about this new buzzword of actionable insights. But to answer your question, what does my company do? So I have two companies. One is where I spent, I would say like 70% of my time is on Set and Compass. And what we do is we really advise companies and we work with them to implement big data systems that are human centered. And we advise companies essentially how to move at the speed of their customers. And in order to move at the speed of their customers, most companies think that they can do that just by collecting enough quantitative data. And they think that by collecting all the mobile data that's out there and all the web browsing data and third-party data and first-party data, that alone will help them move at the speed of their customers. And we say, no, you can't do that because that only tells you what people are doing. You have no idea why they're doing that. And that's why you have to integrate the thick data component, which is just a fancy, a new word that I coined for the community to use to make qualitative, ethnographic, anthropological, sociological data sound sexy in a room of data scientists and C-suite people. And I want everyone to use this word. I'm on a mission to say, just please use it, because the more people use it, the more we all benefit as an industry in this space, because no one understands what the fuck an anthropologist does. We just have with that first. No one gives a fuck. And you know what? No one gives a shit either. No one gives a shit that you're an ethnographer and that you got a PhD. No one gives a shit that you have rigorous approaches. I get so mad. That is like another thing I piss off at. Was when I'm like, when anthropologists are like, we need more rigor, you know? I'm like, you know what? Who gives a fuck? Because what matters is that you can make an impact on the business. How you get there with rigor or not, no one cares. They just, they're going to pay you. You can hold yourself to an excellence of rigor. I do that, right? I do that with my fellow, my community, my peer group of ethnographers. We geek out on rigorous methods. But no one else cares on the business end. They just want you to give them, now in this case, truly the insight that is actionable that will drive a business result. That's what they're going to measure you on, not how fucking rigorous your process is and your methods, you know? And so we work with companies to ensure, and what we do though is that, so it makes me a bit of a contrarian, but you know, my business partner, Matt LeMay, is a really well-known product manager. And, you know, he is in the tech world, API evangelist at Bitly, he led Songza through their Google acquisition. So I have a partner who's very deep in the tech world, Google acquisition. And we created, it's called the Unlock Practice. And we teach, you know, companies how to do sprint-based research so that anyone can do research, whether you have formal training or not. And that research can be quantitative or qualitative. So you can work with data science and you can work with thick data. You know, that to me is really important, because in this new world of research, this is something I talk with Nalini Kodamajar, who's the head of research at Salesforce. Her and I are going to be writing a book about this, which is that, what is the role of research now? What has changed? And we think everything has changed except for the research industry hasn't gotten caught up. And that's a whole set of reasons we can get into later if we want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But I think most researchers are just still operating in the dinosaur ages. And what we created at Sudden Compass is a practice that enables anyone in the organization to do research quickly and come up with insights in a way that you can have no data background, no training. You don't have to have a PhD or a master's in anything. And as long as you're basically an intelligent human being, you can learn this practice. And what's important is that it creates a shared language across organizations, so that someone so a product manager, you know, a PM can learn this too. You know, so Matt, that's interesting for you. I know you have a big product software background, and anyone to a C-suite leader, to a manager, to a designer, and to a researcher, anyone can speak the same language. And that to me is very, that to us is one of the biggest problems we've seen inside organizations, which is a silo and a lack of a shared language or framework. So this is what we teach. And we just gave our first lab at Enterprise UX. This is my favorite conference of the year for our community. It is surprising that it's a UX conference, because usually UX is a bit narrow and that they're usually talking about like how to improve the UI or a feature here, an optimization funnel. But Enterprise UX is not like that at all. It's a beautiful conference that's run by, as we all know, Lou Rosenfeld, the Rosenfeld Media. And they publish really great books for, you know, designers and UX and researchers. And they host a annual conference called Enterprise UX. And that part that, you know, it gathers, and what I think it's indicating what their conference shows is that UX is really pushing enterprises to become the connective tissue of modern organizations. Mm-hmm. And so we gave our first lab there for we opened it up outside of our partners, because our work for the last 4 years, the only way you could go through our practice to learn our practice was you have to become a partner of ours, meaning a client, and you have to sign a six month to 2 year contract with us, because every partner we work with is it's at least a 1 to 2 year, 3 year transformation process where we work with your entire company to transform your data culture and to enable everyone to speak this shared language so that then you can move at the speed of your customers. And it meant that if you're just like a lone UXer or someone who's like, I got a small team, we couldn't work with you. We didn't have that capacity. But because we've tested this out at all scales within an enterprise and we now really trust this, we now are like, you know what? I think we're ready to teach this so that, you know, someone, we can package enough of our work in one day that a team could take this and not have to hire us ever again. Hmm. And they can, just pay a small fee for the Enterprise UX conference. And they for this lab, and they can walk away with an immense amount of basic. Sorry, did my Slack just go off? Do I need to turn that off? I should mute all that. So that way, it was the first time that we had about 60 people from 60 different organizations, from really senior researchers to junior PMs to very senior, you know, VP leaders of insight groups, all across the board. 60 people in a room. We taught our practice for the first time in Enterprise UX. So hopefully we can do it again next year. But that's a bit of a review of what we do at Set and Compass. And my other company, Magpie Kingdom. Should I pause? You guys, I feel like I've been talking for a long time.
we can throw some comments at you. It's funny, one of the things that makes me think of the idea of like the way you do the unlock practice is actually like Hinge, the online dating website. They hired a anti-retention specialist. And the idea being like, how do we make our practice so effective and transparent that you don't need to keep using the app? And this, obviously, it's a very different example, but this is a really interesting question of like, how does, it's almost like planned obsolescence by making everything excellent, you know?
Yeah.
It's a really intriguing idea, I think. That's a cool way to think about what the unlock practice is about. I don't want to stop you from talking about Magpie Kingdom, but that's a thought that I had when you were saying that.
But that is key to our practice. Quick comment. Our companies. Oh, what?
So quick question related to what you were saying. So you mentioned sprints. So you're teaching this in, you know, pretty much a rapid format. Now, I was recently at an event where there was a younger anthropologist who was basically saying, I can't find a job that says anthropologist and I want to be doing research. And we already heard your comment about rigor. So, you know, I get the sort of perspective you have. But if you're fitting this into sprints, could you share with the listeners, you know, what kind of methods you're employing in a corporate environment? Because many of the people who would listen would be coming out of academia and are probably new to the fact that in the business world, we do this in a very rapid way, you know, within dev sprints, you know, and staying ahead of the dev team. And it's probably very foreign to still many of the listeners. So would you just elaborate on that?
Yes. So I think it's... the way we teach our practice is that what we did was we created a practice that is built on the way existing businesses work. So Matt LeMay, being from the product world, and I also working with software developers closely inside R&D, we wanted to create a practice that organizations already are using. And wonderfully, there is a practice called, you know, sprint-based work, which you learn in Agile or in Lean. And I was like, this is actually brilliant, because there's a big revolt against waterfall, which is, you know, long planned out software processes where it's like 6 to 1 year roadmaps, right? And by the time you make the product, you're just like, what the fuck, this is shitty, and the user, it's not even good for the user, and the whole team doesn't even know why they're doing it, and then there's been so many handoffs that like the teams don't even know what other teams are doing. So there, someone's already solved for that, right? And so I was like, why not build a research practice that is based on the sprint-based model, and why don't we just, like, you know, slide right into that and use all the terminology and use all the best principles, but then also I wanted to solve for the problem of the lack of integration around big and thick data. And so I created a framework called integrated data thinking. And this is my time, I created this after Nokia, when I realized that the disconnect between big and thick data was so big that this wasn't just it wasn't something you could logic your way out of. And so I needed to create ways for the brain to shortcut, to create a shortcut for really understanding this. So what's better than a really great heuristic? And so I've been out there evangelizing for this framework that I call integrated data thinking that I created, that unifies, for me, the first time. And I think that's the first method heuristic that does that. I haven't found anyone else who can say they did do that. But so I really believe this is the first heuristic that unifies the methods that are quantitative leaning and qualitative leaning, along with mapping it onto another axis of what's a method when it's appropriate to be used for discovery-based work versus downstream optimization work. And I think that is what's key. When you're being trained in academia, it comes kind of intuitively what methods to use, because you're pretty much always discovering stuff. You're not ever forced to actually create and prototype anything, to test anything out. So you're really never moving into methods that you would ever be forced to really understand why you need, what are you optimizing for? You're not bringing a product to life. And so I desperately needed that as someone who was transitioning in between. I've always been in between worlds, in between academia and essentially industry. You know, I'll categorize industry broadly as like, it could be social justice work, impact, nonprofit, corporate, whatever. But it's like, you know, industry, like stuff, all the great world that happens outside of academia. And moving in between those worlds, I was like, there is nothing that helps anyone, you know, me unify. How do I even talk about qualitative versus quantitative, and at what point are you using them versus, you know, when you're doing discovery-based work versus optimization work? And I wanted to solve for the problem of executives questioning me, like, if I wanted to do ethnography, they'd be like, well, why don't we just do a focus group? And it's like, no, we're not doing a focus group. And then I have to explain why. And then I have to look for articles and respectively be like, I know you really want a focus group, and that's a great idea, but here's some articles to explain why, you know? Yeah. And then you have people who are like, and then I'd be like, I want to do a focus group because this is why. And they'd be like, no, I think you should do an ethnography. And I'm like, what? You know, now I have to explain to you why I think doing a focus group is the best thing to do at this point in time, you know? And then I have to send articles to them about, no, it's not that all focus groups are bad. It's not like we should just ban them. It's because we have to know when to use them. And so I just found myself spending so much time wasting my time and other people's time explaining things to them. So I was like, can I find a quick way to a visual to explain all this? And I was able to create that. And that's the core. That's one of the key components of the Unlock practice, which is this framework called integrated data thinking. And it makes it easy for anyone to understand when to do that. And so when to use what methods. Now, the question of like what methods you use, that's easy. You just have to take some training and understand, you know, that means like you actually have to learn what are all the possible methods that are out there. But that's not something that anthropologists own. You know, that's like something that product managers know well, or UX researchers. They know very well the downstream stuff. I think the value that academics bring to this space is they know a lot of what the discovery kind of methods would bring, like doing large, like, you know, doing more ethnographic based work. Whereas UX researchers and product managers are really good at doing more like downstream, like, you know, A/B testing and focus groups.
That's super interesting to think with. If thinking with that, like, you know, is there, because I think you're absolutely right in terms of, I like the way you sort of separate discovery and sort of downstream research methods. And are there places, I've seen things like, you know, General Assembly, if people wanted to kind of, and I've heard a lot of students that were anthropologists that wanted to go into industry, they would take something else like a technical training, like GA or other kind of online classes. And do you know of other resources like that, where like anthros or sociologists or social scientists could get this kind of downstream methodologies? Like, are there other places where, because I agree, like, this is, I'm thinking about this too, because I haven't really seen that. You know, there might be some LinkedIn learning stuff, you know, but there's not a huge, like, easy repository I know of.
No, actually, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the mystery.
Product School, also along with General Assembly, is pretty good. They're in New York, I think, San Francisco, a few other cities.
Yeah, the problem with, like, Product School and all of these things, I mean, they're great for teaching you the methods, you know, of all those, these, you know, I don't know the resources. I'm sure there's plenty out there. But the problem is they don't put into the context of saying, these methods that we're teaching you, there's a certain time and place to use them. They don't give you the entire spectrum of, like, that's a specific point in the product development cycle. Right. Yeah. And so you're actually, we're teaching you a limited set of tools, and you have to then, you can only, and it's only useful when you're asking this question. For example, you've already done all the user research. You've already, like, you know, ruled out all the unintended consequences of your product. Or so that's the problem, is that it's a bit siloed off from the discovery kind of base work that I see that's sorely missing amongst UX researchers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, this you have me thinking too that actually, to come back to one of your first points, was when you're saying, when you first realized, like, trying to be this sort of one level up from social scientists, who, of course, we all already understand. Oh, you say ethnography, you say certain kind of discovery research. We're like, yeah, you can be with that, but then once you kind of take one step up, if you're going like PM, product manager, or above to C-suite, you know, and like they don't necessarily, as you said, understand what the problem is. And so I think one of the themes I hear you pulling out through all this is, like, there is this notion of language, and like what context matters so deeply in this. Yes. Like, that's why I see why you call this fieldwork in its own level, because it is like getting the context through which the problem itself can even be articulated, right?
Yeah.
And like that's great. Like, and it's one of those pieces too, because it's like you know I'm with you there, where I kind of see this in the ether, in between the worlds. Like yourself, I'm trying to move in between these two kind of academic and applied or industry areas, and it is this interesting, like, hazy world in which you understand ethnography, but, like, you know, certain methods may or may not be available to you, or but then articulating why that would be value to a company is quite tricky. So you know, what kind of strategies do you have? Like, you have the unlock practice and the integrated data thinking. Are these kind of like, and it seems to me, like, on a broad level, that, like, people would be really jumping into this. Like, you know, you've really made an excellent name for yourself in your work. And you just came off of doing some work with Spotify, I remember reading, and, like, sort of helping their entire program become more human-centered, which is so interesting. I mean, is there differences in companies that you work with in this regard? Like, I don't want to say, is Spotify different from Nokia? I mean, they are, but, like, you know, is it just in general, like, humans are pretty good at tapping into their inner human when you say, this is how you use this data set, this way of thinking?
I think there's the question of, like, how are there similarities between companies? Are they different?
Yeah.
And how I think every company, every organization we've ever worked with is its own beautiful nation, its own beautiful culture. And they are as different as, you know, Ethiopia is from South Africa. Like, every organization has its own culture, its own norms, and its own people, its own history. And it takes so much time to really understand how an organization works. And only until you understand that can you really be effective in your work. Mm-hmm. And I for this kind of work to succeed, we have to be able to customize it. So that's why our work, we say, you know, you can learn this stuff, but in order to, for an organization like at a larger enterprise that wants to see real transformation, we have to customize it. And so that what we do is the plan obsolescence, you know, which is that we want to customize it, we want to teach it to you, and then give it to you. And we don't want to be these traditional McKinsey-like consultants that want to stay on forever. Because success would be us getting out of your way so that you can start doing this when we're not around in all your businesses. But no, each organization is so different. Of course, there's, like, you know, broad similarities across organizations. Like, yeah, everyone has, like, politics. Everyone has silos. Everyone is dealing with, you know, struggling with data. But at the end of the day, in terms of implementing it, you have to really understand, because they're so different in the way that people, like, because people are different. So you have to understand the history of all the people who got to where they are and who hold those positions of power. And it takes so much, it's so much relationship building.
That's really interesting. I love this insight about each company being its own sort of independent culture or nation. So thinking about that, do you think that these companies, whichever one you may be working with, is aware of how different it might be from the next?
No, because I don't even think they're asking that. I think when you're a company, you are so, everyone who is on a business is so focused on their own business. This is the problem when you're working, when you are also raised, you know, in wherever you are, is that it is so easy to become focused and on your own perspective that you are, and for any business, the question is just, how can I optimize? How can I grow my business? You become so focused on your own business language, your own business culture, that what it does is that you forget to see the world from the very perspective of the people you're trying to serve. Mm-hmm. So I think this happens with nations, is that you, and then you get obsessed with preserving the own systems that help you grow the system, to help you grow the business. And you see, this is just any kind of institutional hardening. If anyone, you know, anyone who does research on institutions, this is what happens, whether you're a nation state or your business, is that when you create the very own systems to support your existence, you start to see the world through the lens of that system as opposed to the people you're serving. So that's why when you're in a, you know, for a nation, it's like, oftentimes the systems that the government creates don't serve the people. It only serves to perpetuate the existence of the nation as opposed to serving the citizens in real time. Same thing with companies. And that's the value of anthropologists, social scientists, sociologists, that we can come in and say, look, like, we can help you see the meta level. Is that my job when I go into organization is to say, I'm here to help you see the unknown. I understand you're seeing the lens through your business, and you're doing a great job at that. I can't do what you do. And thank God I don't have to do that, because, you know, then, you know, the stock market would be a mess. Like, right, they have to do a lot of stuff. Like, they have to hit monthly goals, quarterly goals. Like, it is, you know, they have to maintain their P&Ls. Like, it is really high pressure to maintain and grow a business. It's unbelievable the stress you have to go through. And then slowly what happens is your world becomes smaller and smaller. You only start to see the world through your own business. That's why all businesses have to work with external partners, I believe, to always help them, lift them outside, give you moments of to breathe and to increase the breathing space, to be like, okay, I know you need to optimize for growth. I know you're trying to meet your shareholder value, but also my job is as your external partner is to help you see the unknown. And when you can create a beautiful partnership like that, when you can create that kind of trust, and it's what I couldn't do at Nokia. I didn't succeed there. I failed. And, you know, someone might say, well, yeah, sure, you came in as like a junior R&D researcher. Like, you really thought you're going to succeed? By talking to the CEO, I was like, yes, I did. I thought I could succeed, you know? But I understand it was very naive. It's like, I know a lot more about the corporate world now, but that kind of relationship that I wanted to build is what I can build now with corporations, is that I want to build that relationship with the C-suite. So I can say, I totally see what you're doing, and my job is to help you understand the unknown and to create space within your organization so that you can then have a culture where it's not just relying on me to help you see the unknown, like relying on an external partner, but you have a distributed department of the unknown within your own organization so that you can create a culture where people can always raise data or information or insights that are not known to within your existing business perspective. We have a practice in the Unlock Sprint. One of the first steps is called ask. And this is always the most revolutionary step that we teach in our practice. And people walk away with their minds blown, is that the first step is to translate and to restate a business question and to translate that into a human question. So business leaders, they know what their business questions are. They stay up all night. You know, as a product manager, you know exactly what business problem you're trying to solve. You know, as the, you know, chief supply chain officer, she or he knows exactly what they're trying to solve. You know, everyone in a business knows, at least a good business leader should know what business question they're trying to solve. When I created this practice, I was like, but do we always know what the human question is? We all know what the business question is. And that was my first insight working inside corporations and doing my own ethnographic work, was like insight number one, which is that everyone knows what their business question is. Not everyone can articulate what the human question is. I know that may sound so basic, but it was revolutionary for me. It was a very epiphanic moment of being like, oh my God, so if they don't know what it is, what if one of the first steps in the practice that I build and that I teach organizations to do is to translate the business question to a human question? And I'm not going to get into it now of how to do that. But the point is that like all of our work, our practices are built off of deep ethnographic work and insights that I saw business leaders struggling with. But it comes first from a very deep respect of the work they're doing.
So for somebody who might be trying to get into this work that doesn't have, you know, a TED Talk as watched as yours, or, you know, a portfolio like yours, how can they sort of become, you know, do what you're doing, whether they're applying to work in an organization or they're trying to start their own consulting practice? You know, if you, I guess if you failed at Nokia,
yeah,
what would you do today differently if you were getting started?
Oh God, so much. I feel like I just got started. So like, this is very fresh to me. But first of all, my first take is don't start your own consulting practice. Like, I don't know why you need to be inside learning. How can you start your own consulting practice when you have no idea how organizations work? And I want to say, yes, I understand I have my own consulting practice, but first I want to say I did not intend to do that. It was because I couldn't get the job that I wanted. And if I could have gotten the job I wanted, I would not have my own practice. But the job I wanted was to have someone allow me to oversee all data in the organization, qualitative and quantitative. And people looked at my background. They're like, are you crazy? You have a PhD that you just graduated. You've only held some R&D positions. You haven't spent 20 years in corporate America. And now you all of a sudden want to be given like a VP level role of being in charge of all insights or all data. Like, you're crazy, right? And so I knocked and knocked on doors. I did all these interviews. I could barely even get an interview in the first place. And so then I was like, I just can't get inside organizations. And slowly, because I was writing about my work and writing about what I was seeing, though, was that organizations started calling me, asking me just to give them advice and just to give a talk inside or a brown bag lunch. And I started slowly doing that. And then they started to hire me to help them with these, to do exactly what I wanted. What I realized was that to do what I wanted back then was very revolutionary. I think it still is, which is to oversee all data. And it's easier to do that as an external person because it's so, data is so political. Data is as political as it can get right now. You are stepping into a minefield when you walk into the world of data, because data is owned by fiefdoms and organizations, right? Everyone's got their own spreadsheets, their own architecture, their own vendors that they're using within one organization, and no one knows what the other function is doing one door down. And so data is highly political. So it was actually very useful as being an external partner. It made sense, right? But I fell into that. It wasn't like I woke up, I was like, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur. It's like, that's retarded to be an entrepreneur. Why would I want to take that risk on? And like, when I don't know what I'm doing. And it's like, I'm making this up as I go, because it's not like there's some organization I can see before me that had, you know, was doing this kind of teaching organizations how to integrate, you know, quantitative and qualitative data. So I would have much rather had a job internally, because I would have learned in a whole different way, right? But that's not how it worked out. That's not how my life worked out. But I still don't have anything against going inside organizations. I'm happy to do that one day. But one, it's like, don't start your own consulting business, because you need to learn. You need to go inside organizations and you need to learn how they work. And what I would suggest is that you have to learn their language. If you go in and you're saying, oh, I can't find a job. Like, I do have a lot of people who are like, I look for jobs that have like the word anthropologist in there. I'm like, oh, good luck. You know, you're no business exactly. It's like, okay, newbie move. You're not going to find a job as an anthropologist. Organizations don't know what they do. And, and so I think the first thing is like, you really have to learn the language and really understand what businesses want. So how do you do that? Well, you just have to be a lateral learner. You have to go to anywhere you can learn, like go to talks, go to, you know, product meetups, go to UX, like go to enterprise UX, go to conferences. Enterprise UX is such a great learning field. It's like a minefield of insights, right? Go to conferences. You know, Rosenfeld Media also has Design Ops coming up in November, where I look for conferences that bring together multiple functions. So I can at one conference hit up product managers, UX researchers, consumer insights people, and like, so I can understand all of their perspectives. I spend so much time with software developers, with also straight up hardcore engineers. I spent time with PMs. Like, I spent so long just trying to understand, what are the business questions that different people ask? What do they see? What's at stake for them? And who do they love working with? Who do they not love working with? Like, you really have to understand the ecosystem. And I think, you know, newbie academics, my first problem with academics going in is you're already fucked if you're like, oh, I can't get a job in academia, so I guess I have to work inside industry.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, thanks for being so respectful to all of us who work in industry. Uh-huh. Like, yours is plan B. Like, and you're approaching it with that kind of attitude. Like, I wouldn't fucking hire you, you know? Like, Like, mm-hmm. go bring that attitude somewhere else. Like, if people are like, oh, I couldn't get that, like, professor to tenure role, so, you know, now I have to go inside corporations and work. And I'm like, no, then, like, get out of here. Like, you are not showing any respect or any kind of curiosity for the intense and the beautiful ways that the work is very different, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you see this as plan B, and you see this as, like in a way that's negative, you know, I get it, everyone has plan C and B, I have, but what I mean is, like, that kind of, you know, just that kind of attitude of to not bring a respect to this kind of work. Mm-hmm. I think first you have to actually like see that this work is valuable. And to me, this work is so much, has its own kind of impact. Sometimes academics see that their work is more unbiased and it speaks to a higher level of truth, you know, and we're all laughing because like, obviously we don't all think that, but that I see that all the time where people think they're making a compromise. Like the question of even like, am I compromising my values by going inside corporations? It's like, no, it's like, if you, I don't see it as a compromise. When I get asked that question, it only fires me up more to do what I do, because I see my form of work inside corporations is, I see my work as a form of social justice, because I'm fighting hegemony in whatever form it takes on. And there is nowhere that it, in corporations, it is so impenetrable. It is so hard to get in there that if you can succeed to fight hegemony inside corporations, then you've done amazing work. And I have high respect for you. You know, like, it's easy to think that you can write and study hegemony from a political ivory, I mean, from an ivory tower. It is a whole different battle when you have to do it internally. And I'm not saying one is the better. I think we need all of these. We need to have all of these ways of fighting. But I really disagree when people see it as a form of compromise and that they're selling out by going into corporations.
And so related to that and your statement about it, about data being political. So obviously data is not only political in terms of who owns it and what they're, why they're collecting it, or how they're collecting, but also why they're collecting and what they're doing with it. And so, of course, now we have lots of systems that are, you know, like police systems that are sort of carrying out or amplifying existing like racism and so on and so forth. So do you have any experiences working in that space, and how do you sort of navigate that?
Absolutely. So I am very committed to fighting hegemony as it shows up in data. And right now, I think we are at a massive threshold right now, crossroads. Of what do we do about our personal data, and how is our data being represented? Because to me right now, the conversations are, you know, around where you see Google's deep learning mislabeling Black people as gorillas. That is an example of data as being politicized, and that someone was not aware of the data practices. You know, you can see how it's hurt people. When Compass, ProPublica did a really great piece about how courtrooms are using algorithmic, you know, risk assessment software, and it's giving Black people higher risk assessment scores than white people, you know, and when it's clearly that the white person has committed more crimes and is a greater danger to society, but Black people are labeled as higher risk because of all the historical data they use and all the ways that bias and race and racism shows up in algorithms. So we are at a massive crossroads right now of that people's data are being used by systems without context and also without their approval. And here we are talking about privacy as the main problem. That to me is we are not even talking about what the real problem is. It's that here we are being so angry about, well, is Facebook, you know, misusing our data? And they have now currently a campaign where they're like, data misuse is not good and we don't encourage it. And it's like, no, you guys are liars. First of all, this is not data misuse. Organizations and corporations are not misusing data. They're abusing data. First, let's be clear about what the problem is. There's abuse. And when there's abuse, there's a clear perpetrator. And what we're talking about is not privacy being on the line. It's personhood. And what personhood is, and you guys did a great episode on this with, women's rights. I remember one of the earliest episodes about personhood is that.
Yep, reproductive rights.
Right, reproductive rights. And the court ruling, So personhood is about your agency to carry out and to make decisions over your life. That's what's at risk right now. And that to me is the biggest battle we have to fight around data is not privacy. Because privacy, we've already unknowingly or knowingly given away so much data. And that is such a leftover. I'm not saying privacy isn't important, but we have a bigger issue at stake, which is personhood. And that's what connects me to all my research in China. The reason why I I did my research and my dissertation in China. My question was, is personhood possible in an authoritarian state where privacy is not possible? If you don't have a society where the norms of privacy are not possible, you don't grow up even thinking you have privacy because you live in an authoritarian country where your data is already owned by the government, then to the West, then you're screwed. You know, from a Western perspective, you're screwed. And I was like, I don't think so. I want to understand, how did all these authoritarian countries, how did people make do in their life? You know, what happened in Eastern Germany? What happened in Russia? And so I was like, here's a living example of China. And it just so happens to be the largest group of internet users in the world, and we know nothing about them. And what the answer I came to is, yes, personhood is possible, even in an authoritarian country where privacy is not possible, because people find ways to be pseudo-anonymous. People find ways to route around the system. And that's why, and my research flies in the face of all of the traditional press, the mainstream press you would see on China, which is that, you know, China is this big repressive state where it's a black hole and information doesn't get out at all. And the only person we talk about is Ai Weiwei. And then the West is like, yay, artist Ai Weiwei. And it's like, yes, because he speaks for all of China. And like, no. So I was like, no, that is not China. You know, China is actually a place where so many wonderful, amazing innovations, beautiful things happen. And you, Westerners, innovations, beautiful things happen. And you, Westerners, can't see it because all these censorship issues. When you, if you actually, as, you know, a social scientist, I live with people, I understand people, it's what we all do. And when you actually live with people, you find out what's being reported and what policy is very different from reality and like the lived experience of different people. And that's why when I met Christina Xu, you know, she is also a really great ethnographer about, I mean, one of the best living, best ethnographers, I think, about China and subculture and music. And so her and I, we co-founded Magpie Kingdom. And we were simply like, you know what, we're tired of bitching about how there isn't great press coverage of China. And we're not getting the right businesses coming to us with the right problems, because we have businesses being like, can you help us improve our ad for China, the Chinese market? You know, and we're like, no, wrong question. Is that you need to be asking a much more strategic question, is does your product even make sense for the Chinese, like, you know, consumers, and what do they want? And so we're like, you know what, instead of complaining about how we're not getting the right business questions, because we don't want to be these downstream research vendors, and there's a million other ones you can hire, and good ones, and we were referring people to our friends who run really great research agencies who are willing to take on those kind of questions, because, you know, we weren't interested in those, and we also didn't have the bandwidth for that. So we were like, instead of complaining about it, again, why don't we write about it from the perspective that, why don't we start reshaping the conversation? So that's why we have Magpie Digest, which is a free weekly newsletter about the topics that we see that are not covered in China. And so I co-founded that with Christina Xu and Fiona Chen, who is a researcher who I trained in China during my dissertation. And I created a whole entire research team. And that's a whole other topic of how I worked with a team to do my research, whereas I think most social scientists work alone when they're doing field work. I've always believed in collaborative work. And so I trained her and a team of people to do research, and now she's become a really great researcher and a VC in China. So the three of us started Magpie Kingdom, and that's why we have a free weekly newsletter, Magpie Digest. And that's my second company where I spend about 25% of my time.
Very cool. That was a great way to circle back around to the second company.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It made it happen.
High five. That was great. actually, I mean, one point I want to tag in, and we're getting a little close to time.
Okay.
But one thing I'm happy to keep talking forever, but, you know, but one thing I think it was really great to think with also in general too, is once you mentioned, to kind of jump back a little bit to this question of, you know, the wonderfully poised idea of like, I couldn't quite get the job that I wanted. So I ended up, you know, but and like kind of bouncing between, companies thinking about it. This is really great to think with, because the piece that you mentioned with that I want to underscore for listeners is that you wrote about your experiences when doing that.
Right.
And, you know, and you've been the pioneer of certain things like live field noting and stuff, and sort of helping bring out sort of the methods of understanding and knowing as you do them. And like, I think this is a key piece I want to reemphasize again, that so we can remember that, you know, we don't have to have the answers if we're looking for something, you know, but the idea is like, when we take the time to journal about it, write about it, make it known and make, you know, it accessible to people, then we do have the time to sort of generate it. And then like this, like, you know, the sense of self and being and professionalism came out of that, which I think is really cool. That's actually really inspiring, because I know for most, a lot of people coming from academia, going to industry, or attempting to, yeah, the interview itself, like understanding corporate language is such a hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what we are good at doing is communicating. And so anyway, I underscore like the importance, and I think the great thing to reflect on that is that like, we should be sharing our experiences, particularly as we try to sort of figure out these sort of impenetrable worlds. Because even I'm thinking of reflections of that, and as you said too, about how corporations themselves can seem so impenetrable, and they're siloed. And so even like, you know, having something that is a, a sort of data czar, as it were, is, you know, not quite there, because you're right, this is a political field that's fraught. And so I don't know. Yeah, I mean, getting this notion of open communication is so key and so hard.
It's so hard because we're trained in academia to not share what we're doing. We're trained to like hang on tight to our research. And when I wrote Life Field Notes, you have no idea how much like how I had professors asking me to leave my department. Like, how dare you share your Life Field Notes? You know, like, and I was like, well, I'm not sharing things that are going to be personally identifiable. And I want to hear feedback right away. And like, will you share that? If you can share with your professor or someone on your chair, you know, your dissertation committee or like a fellow grad student, you don't have to put it on the internet, on Instagram for people to see. And I was like, why not? Why wouldn't I want to get like all this feedback from there? Why wouldn't I want to allow journalists to follow my work? And it was just like, I was asked to leave the department. They're like, well, maybe you want to be like in international studies, you know? And so it was just like them being rude because they see international studies as like, you know, something lower, which is also screwed up. You know, that's a whole different topic around how sociology is dying, because they see themselves as like better than everyone else and they're quantitatively driven. But anyway, they it's like we're being trained in a certain way in academia. And at some point you have to decide that you just don't care what other people think, and you have to figure out what is the higher vision for why I'm doing this. And I find that that's my one piece of advice I want to circle back to, as you said, you know, what advice do I have for people who are out there? And it's like, I think that we all know, like, we're very good at self-care now. We all know what we want to do to improve ourselves. We all have therapists at some point, you know. And but what we need to have is like not just a personal question of like, what do I want out of life, you know, but which is like, what impact do I want to make on society? What's the big question you're trying to answer? And once you figure out that social question that connects you and the rest of society, I think it's not that path becomes clear, but you start to be able to learn how to prioritize decisions and to figure out where you want to be when you can reconcile the personal question you're working on for yourself and the social question that you're working on for your impact on society. Those two things go hand in hand. And for me, my impact on society, the question has changed many times over and over again. It just so happens right now, the current phase of my life, I'm on the question of what are the effects of the quantification bias, you know, when corporations do this, like what happens? And that is a big question I'm working on. So that helps motivate and helps me prioritize what decisions to make. And I think to your point, it's very important that we share our experiences. And that's why this AnthroLife is so important that you guys are doing this, because we don't share enough, because I think academia is all about not sharing and not collaborating, sadly, even though it is, you know, at its core. But it's not like that anymore because of modern education system that silos everyone. But really, the scientific method and inquiry requires us to share and to be collaborative. And what I find is that and that's the second piece of advice I have then for people going out into the field, or for anyone, if you're trying to, you know, I have a lot of, you know, also people who are very senior in our field, but transform themselves because the whole vendor relationship was broken and like they're not getting enough work. So they're like, oh, I want to go in-house, you know, after 20 years of being on my own. I have senior people coming to me like, what advice do you have? And my advice is like, when you're going through a job interview, you need to listen, like really listen. But second, you're also interviewing them. Don't give the corporation all the power to decide like, what, you know, do you fit in with them? It's like you also have to understand, do they fit in with what you want? But that requires you taking the space to think through, what is that social impact I want to make on society, and where do I fit in that, and what's my role in all of that?
So related to that, you have a statement on your website that not everything valuable is measurable, and that certainly can apply to the data we're collecting, but it also can apply to how we sort of gauge our own trajectory and what we're trying to solve, you know, in society and why we're trying to do it. So how do you, how do you sell that concept, you know, like when you're talking to data scientists or even executives who that probably makes their head spin a little bit. But two, how do you also sort of gauge your own performance along the path of what you're trying to do for society?
Oh God, those are two very different questions. I'll be trying very concise. I think the first question is actually, that's why I find that really smart senior people, senior C-suite leaders, a C-suite leader and senior people, and just data scientists, anyone who's smart, if you just sit down and explain to them, look, like what you're collecting is already, you've already determined what you need to collect, right? So that's why you're collecting data on it. But what about all the things that you didn't know, so that you're not collecting data on? and all the unknowns. So you have a lot of whats. You have tons of great data on the whats, but you don't even know why that data is happening. And on top of that, you don't know what you don't know. And I find that to be pretty easy to explain once you just break that down. And of course, I have like all my talks are about breaking that down. But really, this is about just breaking the logic down. And all the words that I just used are totally human words. It's not specialist words at all. It's like, look, do you want to find out things that your business doesn't already know? Don't you, if you care about innovation, don't you want to do that? Yeah, okay, so let's talk. And it's like, that's it. That's the opening, you know? So that's the first one. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more I do, but we don't, you know, that's a whole different conversation. But really, it's not that. It's like just being human. I find that like so many, you know, people going from academia into industry make it more difficult. We're taught to make things more difficult. That was like, and I literally had to like unteach myself all the things I learned in academia. I had to unteach myself when I went into industry. And I had to learn how to be human. Because really what you're taught to do in academia, especially when you're writing a dissertation, it's like you have to be a robot and you have to conform to the system and do what the system tells you to do. Write a paper in this way, write a dissertation in this way, click these boxes. The bureaucracy you have to go through as a grad student, I mean, I know there are other more difficult bureaucracies, but still it's like people have no idea. This is why grad students come out so fucked up. You know, it's like you have been stripped of your humanity by your institution and your chair and just intellectually shamed at all, at every point possible. You may have be that one weird person where you didn't go through that, but most institutions, that is the experience of grad school. It is to break you down so that you can then fit in within the system. And that's the job of any institution, right? The system. And so, because like that, they're no different. When you're a VP or you're like, you know, you're no different from another human being. You just have to, you know, they have the same fears. It's just, you know, different language. And then how do I measure my own success? Honestly, I don't even know how to answer that question because I don't even know what I'm doing half the time. Like I am making this up as I go. No, like there are role models that I look to. Of people who are like, oh, they're trailblazers. Like I love having really good mentors. And those are the people who I look to, people who are really great lateral thinkers who have crossed many different roads. Like for example, people are like on my Instagram, we're like, what the fuck were you doing in Tucson, University of Tucson for 2 days, spending time with this guy named Dr. Alan Hamilton, who is a really well-known neuroscientist. He created, you know, non-invasive brain surgery. He was the head writer on Grey's Anatomy, you know, head medical writer. He wrote, you know, The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, The Supernatural, and The Healing Power of Hope. Wow. Yeah, and guess what? He is like a pioneer in bottom-up equine training instead of top-down horse training where you break down the horse. And I now am obsessed with horses after I just got back from Iceland for one day. So I was like, oh my God, I want to be a horse rider. And so I met him and I agreed to speak at this conference just to meet him. Right. I just was like, who's speaking? Because sometimes I go to conferences. I'm not going to go because I don't care about meeting other people. Because when I go to a conference, I'm there not to speak. Half the time I'm there just to meet other people. Like, totally, speaking is an excuse for me to meet other awesome people. So I was like, I'm speaking at this conference. I will make something up to get on stage just smart enough just so I can talk to Alan Hamilton. And then I became friends with him. And then I was like, I need to adopt him as my mentor. So I went for 2 days, spent time in his simulation lab where he taught me how to do perform surgery. Using, you know, simulation methods. And now we're going to be working together on a paper, you know, stuff like that. But that was not the purpose going in. I was just like, he is such a lateral thinker. I need to adopt him as my mentor. I need to learn from him how he dedicates his life to horses, to writing for Grey's Anatomy, and to being the head of the simulation lab and this like amazing neuroscientist. And that's how I measure my success, because I don't know how else to do it, because I need to find other people who have done different things, because my life doesn't even make sense to me. You know, I don't even know why I'm doing half of what I'm doing. But to me, it's really important to have people around you to encourage you. And he was the one who was like, why don't you have a book? And I was like, well, I do have a book coming out, you know, it's coming out like, you know, this year. And he's like, stop it. I hear it in your language. He's like, you need to dedicate all your energy to putting all your ideas in the book. I'm like, well, I'm working on it, Alan. Like, and he's like, no, like, and he just like yelled at me. And he was like, you need to prioritize this. You have been out there speaking and you're afraid. You're afraid of something. And he's right. And that's a whole other topic again, but he was right. And he now is holding me to this thing of like, right, so this year, because of that talk he gave me, I'm like, right, I do have to prioritize putting my book out there. I've been putting out papers and articles and op-eds, but now it's time to put all my stuff into a book. And I have to really deal with the fears around that. So yeah, I have to get a great therapist and make sure I work on that and work on myself so that I can continue, you know, pushing myself and the field in the direction that I think we should all be going into.
Tricia, this has been an incredible odyssey. I really feel like our listeners are going to get so much from this conversation.
Oh my God, it's been an hour. Holy shit. We went
so This is perfect. It's great. It's okay. I feel like the people collectively said, hell yeah.
Whoops.
No, this is great. This is great.
This is so fun. I just like talked.
Yeah, that's the best part, right? See, it's a good. I mean, to echo Ryan too, this has been so much fun and so great. We're definitely gonna have to have you come back, and I want like an episode two is like the fear of Tricia Wang, and like exploring, breaking down, because I think that's actually such an interesting integral piece too. I'm totally inspired to think about that now too. Like, how do we sort of name and understand our own fears and then move past them? But that is a topic for later.
Right.
But super worth thinking about. I don't know. So thank you so much. This has been so much fun to talk and. Incredibly inspiring to hear this non-linear path, lateral thinking, and such an impact you're making on the industry and for social scientists and for corporate world. So you're doing great stuff. I mean, huge inspiration to us. So thank you.
And I think so much of the conversation just really has a take charge feel to it that can really inspire. So, again, just echoing what Adam's saying, this has been just a great pleasure to have you on. Mm-hmm. And I would love to talk more about everything else you're saying, about your book, about the next steps, because this is fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, guys. You guys are so amazing for making this. I just have to tell you, I'm really, really impressed with how long you've kept this up. And I'm so happy we are all in this together.
We are in the fight. The fight is on for us all. You're right. Mm-hmm. Hey, actually, so to close out, where can the good people find you?
They can find me on Instagram or Twitter under Tricia Wang, TRICIAWANG. Yes. So it's Tricia Wang, not Wang. And you can find me through my website also, but I'm pretty easy to get a hold of on LinkedIn or wherever, you know, making myself accessible, which is another thing that young anthropologists and sociologists should do, is you need to be online and you need to share and be accessible to people.
Yeah, amen.
Thanks for tuning in for our episode with Dr. Tricia Wang, and we hope that you're feeling as blown away as we are. But as always, we wanted to give a shout out to our collaborators. This AnthroLife is an official collaborator with the American Anthropological Association, with Sapiens, with the Society for Applied Anthropology, and EPIC.
So yeah, thanks to them for helping us spread the good word and for us bringing anthropology and social science thinking to the wider public. You know, we're all working together in the quest of science communication and showing the value of this kind of thinking. And so yeah, we couldn't do it without you all. And yeah, so we hope you've enjoyed it. It's been a great conversation for us, and we can't wait to see you in a couple weeks. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And this is Ryan Collins.
Thanks for listening to This AnthroLife.